Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are just one of 20-some, associations of meetings throughout the world, and our main goal is to spread, broadcast these teachings that were put down in writing starting in 1875. But these ideas are ancient, they're timeless, they are the basis for all of the major religions that are out there today. And if one would take back the trappings of the current major religions, one would come down to what these ideas are, these universal ideas. And there are no leaders, there's no president, we don't pass around a basket. We feel as though the binding principle among us all is the idea of universal brotherhood, and that is what we want to put forth to all of mankind. And in order to do that, the Lodge here in Philadelphia has two meetings a week. Our Sunday meeting is now. The doors open at 10:30. The meeting runs from 11 until 12. The meetings on Sundays usually follow a more structured pattern. We have an umbrella topic. For February this month, we are investigating the hidden laws of nature. Next week's meeting is on the potency of sound and speech. Last week, we looked at the hidden side of nature, and today we are looking at mental healing and hypnosis. And on Wednesdays, we have a study class, and we're looking at the ocean of theosophy. We're still looking at reincarnation? Is that? Yes? Okay. We are still looking at reincarnation. It's a huge topic in the ocean. We think it takes three chapters, and we kind of cut the chapters in half so one can really see how important reincarnation is. The reading, if you want to come in and prepare ahead of time, the library is open from 5:30 until 7:30 on Wednesdays. And the reading for that night and any reference involved is in the library. If you want to do any individual study, because that is one of our, that's one thing that we do encourage people to do, some independent study, not when you're not here in the meeting room. There's always somebody in there to give you a hand if you're looking for something specific. And the book table out in the foyer has all straight-lined theosophical ideas, and you're only paying for the cost of printing and shipping. And looks like we'll be having a special meeting on Wednesday, March 20th. It's the Wednesday class, and we'll be looking at the life of William Q. Judge, a great theosophist, and his writings, and it's just a very interesting meeting. We do a little biography sketch and do some other of his favorite readings. And the United Lodge of Theosophists is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contribution. Its activities depend similarly on voluntary offerings in time and work. All are invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied.
They want you to speak up.
So today we'll be looking at two different types of healing. It's mental healing and hypnosis. We will start out with mental healing, and then the second talk will be on hypnosis. And as the Bhagavad Gita says, death is certain, why worry about the inevitable? So as theosophists, we kind of look at this as a perspective different maybe from what the majority of people look at. And to look at the health and condition of this mortal coil into perspective, a lot of people will do anything they can to keep, to stay alive, and whatever they have to do to extend their life. But then that perspective is only looking at the results, the cure, and the method, not really looking at the cause. And we'll definitely be going into a lot more of that, because theosophy, when we look at the cause of disease, it's very different than what a lot of people believe. So we'll be looking at today the theosophical perspective and as to the real nature of man and how it pertains to this idea, these ideas of mental healing and hypnosis. And to begin with, we have to look at the idea that man is dual. We have a higher nature of Atma, spirit, buddhi, or spiritual soul, and manas, or mind. And these are, this is the real man. This is the reincarnating portion of man we call an ego. And this is what comes back from life to life. There's no beginning and no ending. And this is what we look at as being the I, what our perception is of ourselves. And then the lower four principles, we have, of course, the physical body. We have prana, which is the life force. And we have the astral body, which is the design body. And then there's passions and desires, which is called kama. And when we look at the idea of the astral body, this is what we're looking at, and more so with hypnosis than with mental healing, but we'll be going into more of that. And the idea that there is no one specific method to cure things validates the idea that there are different types of diseases. And there's many causes. I mean, it could, when one thing that we're looking at is how the body, the physical form, has the lower kingdoms of mineral and plant and animal. They're all in us. And this lower, the lower four principles are the temporary portion of the man. And this gets, when the body dies, we then pick up a new one for the real man in another lifetime. And when the mind is centered on, or is extremely nervous or obsessed, the mind operators, the people in mental healing, the whole idea is if you can get the mind off the body, then this is when these cures can happen. But the interesting thing is, if one can stop obsessing on things, because that stress creates an illness in the body, if they can stop that, the body oftentimes will heal itself. But the mind curers, the mental healers, will say that they did the curing. So it's kind of an interesting perspective. Now, this form that we're in now has come into existence on this physical plane because of karma, action and reaction. There's three types. There's a mental, physical, and psychic karma. It affects all three planes. So we're looking at the cause and effect of what we've done in the past, bringing it forward to how we are now. So when we're looking at the cause and effect with karma, how does karma then interface with this idea of mental healing? Well, the thing with mental healing is we have to look at, what are we trying to heal? If we are looking at the physical cause, we heal it in a physical way, not through the mental. By mental healing, the disease is thrown back from the physical plane onto the mental plane, thus avoiding the natural pathway of resolution of a karmic debt through the physical as the last expression of that lesson to be learned. And we are not to pull the spirit down, which is the root of all. We are not to pull it down to the physical plane to relieve us of our own actions. All action is the result of mind, of thought. So if we're looking at at healing something and it's a physical issue, if we look at, you know, the mind affecting that physical problem and not looking at that physical problem from a physical cure, a lot of times that will throw it back and we will have to experience these issues again in a past life. I'm sorry?
Future.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Future, in a future life. And the mental healing idea, we can look at Mr. Robert Crosby from his article, Mental Healing and Hypnosis. Mental healing, also known as metaphysical healing, mind cure, spiritual healing, and also Christian Science, all come under the same heading. There is no difference between them in the range of their action or the basis upon which they are formed. All are forms of self-hypnotism. Excuse us. Mr. Crosby put hypnotism in a class unto itself, which we'll be looking at shortly. But we look at the general heading of mental healing, and then we will go on to the hypnosis. Now, mental healers and Christian Scientists make use of certain ideas and processes, as we said, which take the mind off the body. The cure is supposed to be obtained by thinking, but is only by taking the mind off the body. HPB says, in other words, whenever a healer interferes consciously or unconsciously with free mental action of the person he treats, it is black magic. And we can see then how the mind is interwoven into the physical. Excuse me. When we look at psychosomatic illnesses, when people say, you know, that it's, you know, because they're upset, because they're worried, it affects the physical body, that's usually looked at as being psychosomatic. And at that point, we're looking at the lower mind. Mind has to be joined to those passions and desires. It has to be connected with it because that is how we learn our lessons. It is the way the spiritual is connected to the form. It's our only connection to this plane of existence. So when we're looking at psychosomatic illnesses, the mind is connected to the body. It's interwoven with it. So if the mind, we're looking mostly at the lower thinking part of the mind, if the mind is connected to the body then, and it is upset, it's focused, it's obsessed on something, that will create that issue in the body. So if the mind can be taken off of it then, as we said, then the body oftentimes will cure itself, not necessarily because a mental healer has gotten involved. And then if we're looking at the idea of hatha yoga, that's kind of doing the opposite. It's focusing on the physical. So it's a shortcut, so they feel, of gaining that type of spiritual knowledge, is going through the physical, bypassing the higher nature to get right to the spirit. And we have to do that through evolution, and that's a totally another topic. And we would like to just read a short quote here from Robert Crosby, and for newcomers, this is The Friendly Philosopher, and it's a wonderful little book, and we have it out at the book table. Where is it? If, perchance, by taking their minds off of the disease, the body gets better of itself, they have gained no knowledge by the experience. So what he's meaning here is that because of karma brings us these bodies and a lot of times these diseases, that if the cure is just to take the mind off of it, we're not learning the experience that we have to learn by having this body with these conditions. They are only made better able to continue along their ignorant lines. They die when the time comes, no wiser than when they were born, believing this to be the only physical existence they will ever have. So, in other words, we have to look at what our problems are and deal with them. If it's a physical illness, you know, there's medications, there's exercise, there's proper diet, there's all these things we can do to help ourselves on the physical plane. If there's emotional issues, then there's you know, psychologists, there's, you know, psychiatrists. So we have to keep them separate, so to speak. And the idea with Christian Science is almost the same thing, but they're turning their will over to an outside God for the healing of their family members, friend, or loved one. So there's that issue, too, of since theosophy puts forth the idea of an inner God, that turning it outward will just take the whole focus off the physical form again. So we will turn this over to my partner here, and we'll take a look at hypnotism.
Well, prior to getting into this hypnotism, we just wanted to bring up the fact that, and we can probably all understand it, that we act one way or the other upon suggestions, basic suggestions that are made to us. And we act from that. And we have to sort of understand that in the ancient teachings and the theosophical teachings, we speak about what we, and we have to say we because we have that higher nature in our lower nature, what we really are. We are thinkers. And we really only see ideas. And it's nothing but ideas that keep us in that area. But we have these powers, power to perceive. We can acknowledge that. To think, to choose, to act. And all our powers are born within us. All from past experiences within. Those are also there. So if we get the idea of we're thinking from a false premise, shall we say, our thinking will can lead us into false conclusions. Now that's just a sign of logic on it. So this idea of hypnotism, it's sort of in the theosophical teachings put as a warning to us. that it's neither a safe nor an assured guide to any useful knowledge. So then, let's just see, what is hypnotism? It is through the flow of the magnetic fluid from the operator to the subject. Through this substance is carried with it the qualities, good or bad, of the operator. This is something to keep in mind. We have been places where we walked into a room and there's a strong feeling of wanting to talk to a certain person. It's just very strong. It's a feeling that we have. Or it can work the other way. You walk into a room at a party or a function, and for some reason, there's something within you that says, let's bypass this crowd and go over and talk to those people over there. It's like a knowing. It's like a sensing. So, it is, in a way, the use of the will, or suggestions, we might say, that acts upon the nervous system of the subject, whether he's aware of it or not. Hypnosis is done in simpler ways. One can use an object to have the subject concentrate on, the old swinging of the clock, the watch, the pocket watch, or it can be through the actual eyes of the operator to the subject, talking him into this hypnotic state. This is done in a way that the individual doesn't really know what's going to happen or what's going on. And we also wanted to remember that the Greek word of hypnosis means to sleep. So this way, in the connecting link that we're talking about, is not technically this physical body, because this physical body is going to very quickly be put to sleep, whether it's a wave of a hand or a certain phrase or a counting of numbers, whatever the operator uses, he's going to put this person out. So that connecting link is, as was mentioned earlier, is that astral body. That has its own parts, its own powers, and its own organs. And it is capable of arousing of great, tremendous force. And it holds like the outer frame intact of the physical body. So, and we were, as was mentioned earlier, it is, shall we say, the program, the vehicle, the pattern for the physical body. Now, the astral senses of any person are the direct inheritance of his own prior incarnations and are not the product of family heredity. These are all within us. We've brought them on ourselves, and we ourselves will be the carry of them. So in this whole process of putting someone to sleep, quote, to sleep, the critical changes that are taking place in that inner makeup of one attending there is a withdrawal of nervous fluid from the capillaries of the nerves, the blood vessels in the veins. There is actually something going on. And it can be done, as we said, with just a wave of a hand, and that person is in a hypnotic state. Now, what can happen within this depends on what the process is and the use of for the operator and the subject. But we also read about post-hypnotic suggestion. There are things that can be told to that individual, that subject, that within a word, a phrase, a time, there will be a command given to them, and they will enact with it. Again, that has a correlation of the atoms, and that too within us can be affected. As was stated before, it's in this pamphlet, it's interesting, it says hypnosis, a psychic malpractice, this idea of warnings. Now, we wanted to bring up the idea of the medical use of it. So we're going to talk about the habits that people will go to a physician to have them hypnotize them in order to have a change in their pattern of life, or one, to overcome alcoholism, to do something about their weight, whether it be to gain or to lose. Simple changes, things like phobias that we might have about things, or even the simplest thing is nail biting. We're going to go to a physician, and he's going to hypnotize us and take it all away. This is what the process is. This is what we're hoping for. But now, again, it is the morality of its use, depending entirely upon the motive, the purity, and the true knowledge of the practitioner, the operator, the doctor. We've already mentioned this post-hypnotic state that goes on. This can also affect similar cases with sleepwalkers or sleep talkers. It's interesting for most people that have been through a hypnotic state that's not of a medical kind, whether it be, you know, at an auditorium with an exhibition of some famous hypnotizer, they do not remember anything that's happened to them during that hypnotic state. They come out, they don't remember what they said or what they did or what silly little thing they might have had them walking on all fours, making animal sounds, any of this. They have no remembrance of knowledge of it. There are people that are just not, quote, good subjects for hypnotic states. This has to deal with, it could be one, a protection of a knowledge they've learned in past lives, and it's just automatically within their aura around them. It can be that they're very, you know, if I can't see it, if I can't touch it, if I can't smell it, it ain't there. That could be a very strong feeling and an opposition. So sometimes if one is hurt, they will bring groups of people up and talk to them prior. And the hypnotist can tell right away who's going to be a good subject and who's not going to be a good subject. And what do we mean by a good subject? Someone that is easily moved by suggestions and is of a passive nature. These are the warning signs that we like to put out. A passive nature. So we get back to this idea of every cell in the body, to the most minute, has its own little series of impressions and recollections. It's just like once you've learned the piano and you've been away for a long time, you can walk up to a piano and all of a sudden your hands know what to do because we've trained the lives, the intelligence within there to know it. And it's there to be recalled at any time. So if we go back to this whole idea of hypnosis and the dangers that are there, we have to understand too that it is the operator's will, not in complete control of the subject, not only of the outer body, but reaches deeper into man's being, opening doors, this is of the subject, which normally remain shut during an average lifetime in certain inner and non-physical divisions of the subject operate on. So when we look at that idea, there are things within us that we have had to experience of being reincarnating as thinking beings for over 18 million years. We've probably experienced everything that's to be experienced within the world. So we are back here in any one lifetime, not primarily for just goodness, but for the lessons that we obviously haven't learned. We haven't learned the balance and the harmony that's within this whole universe and which we are a small picture of. We haven't learned the lessons. But with this idea comes the idea that that power of choice comes in again. We are thinking beings and we have that power. The animal, the vegetable, and the minerals, and the lower elementals do not in a way have that power of choice. They just work under natural impulse. We have an obligation, not only to ourselves, but all those lower lives that are interconnected with us. So it comes with that danger of, is this the kind of thing that you want to be involved in? It's even with the medical things, it's funny. They'll, for a while, get rid of that phobia, or they'll get on this diet and they're doing good. But come along the road, something else happens, and we're back in that syndrome again. In other words, like, well, we took this away, but now this is in its place. This is not the level on which anybody is going to learn or gain any wisdom or knowledge of their true inner spiritual self that we are. And we are told, look within, thou art Buddha. So hopefully you'll have some questions on this idea of mental healing and hypnosis and even mesmerism.
It seems like it is more accepted to partake in the standard medical treatments of today because it's not bad in any way. Yet I haven't heard many cases of diabetes, cancers, epilepsies being cured by standard medicine. Yet Edgar Cayce, who practiced hypnosis, healed thousands of people of the above said diseases. Was he practicing, according to the pamphlet, apparently Cayce was practicing black magic?
Not in that extent. First of all, the only one that was put into a trance was Cayce. And we'll have to remember that he was brought up, I think, in a Christian household, and he had, at a young age, an accident of falling off a ladder. And ever since that time, he would have these things come to him. He, under the hypnotic state, could be talking about someone that was miles away that he had received a letter about, and he could explain what was going on within that individual's physical problem or their mental problem. But he was not hypnotizing subjects with his willpower. He would go into that state, but if you look at it on a theosophical level, he was able to look into the higher grades of the astral light. So he could pick up something from a person, whether sitting right in front of him while he's speaking in a trance, or miles away. So this was what you would call a natural seer in a way. But again, that karma comes in up to a certain point, and then something happened in his life, and all of a sudden, at first he didn't want to believe what was going on. He didn't understand it. He was talking about things he had no knowledge of. I think the man was a photographer. So, do you have anything on him?
Yeah, as was said, Edgar Cayce was one of the few true, what do you call them, medium?
Natural seer.
Natural seer.
You know?
And they're, the thing with Edgar Cayce, he didn't charge anything for any of this. And our understanding is that the suggestions he was making for, like, physical illnesses, he gave physical, you know, he designed potions and pills and things like that. So he was keeping the physical cures on the physical plane. We're not sure what he did in regards to emotional things. We're not that familiar with that end of it. But he did, you know, he did do the physical cures for the physical plane.
Studying his works was that he would go into a deep meditative, at the time they called it trance, but it was actually a deep meditative state where he was still fully aware on this plane, although also aware on a higher plane. And that when a certain amount of time had passed, or his wife stood guard whenever this would happen, she would always be next to him when the sessions were going on. If she had any idea that he was overwhelmed or too tired or that there was danger to him, she would stop and allow him to come back up to the waking state. But we think it's very different from being in a hypnotic state where it's explained another has control over the will of the one. This was a meditative.
Yes, I'm sorry I said the hypnotic because I was just following the hypnotic. But it's true, it was a meditative state, which in a way, each and every one of us, with the study and the correct study of Raja Yoga, you can reach that same state.
I do a lot of practice a lot of things in my meditative states, and one of the things that I did is, like, for example, if I had a mosquito bite, in a fully conscious state, I would focus all of my attention on that mosquito bite, and the mosquito bite would, all of a sudden, the intensity of the itch would expand 1,000-fold to the point where it was almost unbearable. And then if I was able to concentrate for long enough, it would dissolve, and then mosquito bite would go away. So from my standpoint, that's a telling kind of metaphor. Well, not if it's real, it's not a metaphor. So if you can somehow bring somebody and shepherd them into a conscious state where they are able to feel the karmic lesson that's supposed to be felt by that illness in a safe, comfortable place, then you can both have them fulfill their karma but also cure the disease, because the key is to consciously shepherd them into that space.
Well, with one of the issues comes in, and one of the things you said, you were being conscious is a very important part of this, because anybody being passive risks certain dangers. But this was a totally awake, focused event. And the cures that we're looking at from mental healing, as we said earlier, is that by curing it and not learning, by having an outside cure and not learning how to deal with the issue, you can bring that illness back in a future life. Now, we're not real sure about the example that was just given.
Well, one thing it can show you that we do have inner powers that we don't normally use on an average, everyday part of our life. But again, it's the kind of power that you just don't play around with. You have to have some sort of knowledge of what you're really doing, because things can happen and seem very miraculous, and from that you can have bad effects on another level within you. But the fact is, in a deep state of meditation, one can work out maybe mental problems out, but when it comes to, again, the mixing of the physical with the mental, you're getting into a hairline area that something is going to have some other effect that's going to unbalance what you have balanced.
And there's the idea also of psychic powers, that if somebody in a past life, doesn't necessarily have to be the immediately preceding one, but in a past life might have been dabbling in these ideas, and so they are bringing a portion of that forward. And there are some people out there that are able to do this kind of an example. There's some people that, you know, they know when something bad is going to happen, that they can look at a person and know that there's something wrong with them. So we've all, if we've not experienced these ourselves, we've all known somebody who can, and it is a psychic return of something that had been done in a previous life. And again, we need to look at our physical ailments more from a lesson to be learned kind of a thing. Did you have, you had your hand up?
Yes. It is said that the contemporary classical composer, Sergei Rachmaninoff, had burnout at one point, all right? And someone told him that if he went to a hypnotist, that it might help him. And he did so, and under hypnosis, he was told that he would not only be able to compose again, but that he would compose his greatest work. All right, and when he came out from underneath it, he composed his Concerto Number 2 in C minor, Opus 18, which was actually and really, in reality, his greatest work. But he had this burnout, this tiredness, because it is said of all of his piano concertos that they were extremely difficult to play because of the fluidity of the left hand and the pedal work, so as to enable the piano to sound as little like a percussion instrument as possible. But at the same time, nowhere that I've researched said that he was ever left-handed, all right? So it's my contention that perhaps it was just as hard for him in some ways, even though he was trained and trained himself, that it would be for other people to play. What I'm getting at here is I imagine that stress and tiredness and anxiety can possibly be cured under hypnosis.
As we stated, in the medical thing, these things can happen. The problem can be eliminated at the time. But technically, if we use the idea of karma and understanding the cause and effect idea, we might understand that it was like a certain karma was leveled and balanced and harmonized, and then another karma took on. And the individual that was maybe hypnotizing them, being in the psychic realm, was possibly looking into the aura around the individual, because everything is there. That astral, that we speak about, that astral light, that has everything that has been done, that's being done, and will be done. It's like a photo gallery. It's all out there. If someone is psychic enough that they can see into it, they can tell you things, and things can change. But it might have been that he had worked off a certain karma, and what from that one, quote, catastrophe, it was worked off now. New karma came in, and he could continue in his field. Because there are some families that have a great extent, famous ones, of musicians, but yet there's nowhere in the family line do they see it. And when that individual passes, no one in that family line has the same talent. So each one has his own karmic things, his own causes, and he's reaping the effects, and he's the only one, or she's the only one, that can work them out.
Now, the one thing we have to look at, though, is the idea of... just lost our train of thought. That he is, when we're looking at karma, he did not, I mean, there might have been something that he didn't work out. So when we're looking at all these cures, we can't say for certain that it was or it wasn't a legitimate cure. And we need to work out the issues that are happening to us and not have somebody else do it for us, which is what a hypnotist is doing. He's basically working it out for you when we can, but we need to do it ourselves. And we can't say, as we just said, how it was accomplished, if it was something that, you know, was a working out of an old karmic debt, and then a new one started, or what? It's very hard, especially so many years back. You had your hand up.
Yes. there's a couple of things. One is that there's the objective plane and the subjective plane, and although wonderful, miraculous cures can be done on the objective plane, it pushes it back into the subjective. And it, not only does it push it back, but with great force, so it intensifies. So what seems like a great evil in this life can be cured by various means, but it's going to come back with a vengeance. And another point is that when you're hypnotized, you're higher self is paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
You have no control. The spirit, spiritual soul, and your mind principle is completely subservient to your lower animal passions and desires. So there are dangers. There are cures, yes, but there are dangers. At what price? I mean, What price do you want to be cured of something?
Yeah, one thing that does happen in the hypnotic state, once the hypnotist has put the person under, is, as was said, there's a like a disjunction, so to speak, between the higher nature and the lower. So because there's not that connection between the two, The higher nature needs that physical form in order to function and learn the lessons. So that's another reason why we're looking at it being dangerous, because the higher nature isn't getting any benefit from this, really. And it's mainly focusing on the physical, or if any part of the higher nature, it'll be the lower mind. And that's going to drag us down. In the back.
Work that we will produce in whatever way that evolves itself, whether it's, you know, as a teacher inspiring a student who will become a great thinker, or whatever that moment is. And we're thinking in that lifetime that was described, in the throes of the difficulty, this was one way to accomplish that. Suppose suppose, though, Rachmaninoff had gone through all of the difficulties and lived through and worked through and found himself to be so strong as to have done that, perhaps that masterwork might have even been greater. We can't know that.
Right.
It is our duty to deal with whatever that process is, and Theosophy mm-hmm. tells us we are able to. We never get more than we can deal with.
Right. I mean, karma brings us to the lifetime with as much as we can handle.
Lou?
Yeah. When we're faced with serious illness or whatever we're faced with, we don't know whether it is our karma to suffer through this illness or whatever, or whether we are meant to be healed, not necessarily cured. I make a difference between curing and healing. I've been involved in therapeutic touch for many years. Therapeutic touch is a modern form of laying on of hands, which is practiced by many nurses, and it is not invasive. It is not trying to heal the disease. It is alleviating, and the aim is to bring balance. And balance means if karma wants this person to die of this disease, then that is the best thing, and the person will have known. But the therapeutic touch is not a mental healing. It is trying to be in touch with the forces of nature and be in tune. That's the best I can describe it.
Well,
it is not a curative thing.
Well, I mean, the only thing we can think of in regards to therapeutic touch is that when we're looking at hypnotism and mesmerism, we're looking at there's a flow from the practitioner to the recipient. And we don't know the practitioner what type of energy is being given to that person. That's the only thing that we can think of. And again, it's an outside force that is assisting that form to correct itself and is not working on it themselves. And there's still that concern that there's going to be some kind of for loss of a better word, is negative energy being transferred.
May I respond?
Yeah.
The therapeutic touch practitioner is trying and asked to center before attempting any treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And the centering is to be in harmony with the universe and to do the best. I only have seen it work.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was wondering if could either hypnosis or some other kind of outside agency, possibly a therapeutic touch, or if it met certain conditions, for instance, if it led the subject to actually to learn something about what they were capable of
mm-hmm.
Themselves and didn't lead to a dependency on outside agency. And also the other aspect, we've been discussing the negative side, the negative aspects as twofold, both depriving the subject of the ability to gain wisdom and the potential for negative energy coming from the outside source. But isn't it possible that the outside source could, in fact, because, you know, the intention was benevolent and the intention was, in fact, to lead the subject to learn something about their own abilities to heal themselves. And I thought of another example of an outside agency that might do this, that might lead someone to heal themselves. And that's the intentionally giving someone a placebo. And when they realized that they were healed actually within themselves, and it wasn't the sugar pill, haven't they gained some wisdom? And the intention being benevolent, being not only, suppose it wasn't for any kind of profit, or it was merely to instruct this person in these principles, then wouldn't that be a good thing?
That could be a good thing. There are some people that are naturally have the ability to take their hands and put them on another person even. And it's that fluid, that magnetic fluid, that animal magnetism, whatever they want to call it, similar to mesmerism, that they're giving them like some energy and some force of their own. But hopefully that individual is a well-balanced individual, so it's not harming. And if it's like showing someone how to do it on your own, which that's what we're here for. We're here to learn lessons. I can't learn a lesson for you, and it isn't going to help you. I have to learn my own lessons. That's a little different than what we're talking about of being outside controlled.
One of the things that we haven't talked about, we didn't mention yet, is that all of these powers that we're discussing are powers that we will have as we travel along our spiritual path and we gain more experience and more knowledge. So at our stage, most of us, and as we said, we know that there are some true healers out there. Most of us, we may be able to perform these acts, but we don't have control over them. And that's what we will gain as we evolve, is control over these type of practices. So that, and I mean, we don't know if a person comes to us for some kind of healing, no matter what it is, we don't know karmically what has been brought into this life, and we don't know, are we going to disrupt a learning path for them that maybe, as was stated, is going to be pushed back with more force into their next life and may come out even worse? Because, as we've been saying, the physical is the last expression of a karmic lesson. And if we don't let that express, then the person's going to be reliving it in a next life. So we don't know when these people come to us what is going on. So,
and our time is up.
So our time is up.
But the fact of the matter is, if you just use it as a guideline, outside controlling me, no. I have to be the controller myself. And if I want to use yoga, a Raja yoga, not just physical Hatha yoga, but use a mental yoga and heal thyself, as they say. That's it.